From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, search widens for missing Malaysian airliner. Rights groups want protection for 220 Uyghurs detained in Thailand. Will violence disrupt at upcoming Afghan vote? These stories and more in this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. A senior Malaysian official says a signaling system was partially disabled on the missing Malaysia Airlines jet before a pilot spoke to air traffic control without hinting at any trouble. Malaysia's defense minister said Sunday the final words from the cockpit were spoken to Malaysian air traffic controllers after the plane's data communication system had been partially disabled. The pilots did not mention any trouble on board, suggesting they may have been misleading ground control or acting under coercion by someone familiar with aviation technology. Police, meanwhile, have searched the homes of the two pilots and are examining an elaborate flight simulator taken from one of them. Authorities are also questioning engineers who may have had contact with the plane before it left Kuala Lumpur. Malaysia now says 25 countries are involved in the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines passenger jet that disappeared from radar more than a week ago. And as Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok, analysts are calling for greater regional cooperation in air safety and security.
Malaysia's acting transport minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, said Sunday the search for the missing Malaysian Boeing 777 aircraft has increased to 25 countries and a focus on two key flight corridors, one to the Indian Ocean and another extending as far north as Central Asia. Hishamuddin told a press briefing in Kuala Lumpur the extended search areas raised fresh challenges as hopes of finding the aircraft increasingly lay with satellite data.
The search area has been significantly expanded and the nature of the search has changed. From focusing mainly on shallow seas, we are now looking at large tracts of land crossing 11 countries as well as deep and remote oceans. The number of countries involved in the search and rescue operation has increased from 14 to 25, which brings new challenges of coordination and diplomacy.
Hishamuddin also called for the United States, China and France, among others, to provide further satellite details in the search for the aircraft. Senior Malaysian police officers say a formal investigation into the captain and the co-pilot of flight MH370 is underway, with raids on their residences in upscale suburbs of Kuala Lumpur. But families and friends of the men have vouched for their good character. The aircraft left Kuala Lumpur last Saturday morning on a regular flight to Beijing with 239 passengers and crew, but never reached its scheduled destination. On Saturday, Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak said deliberate action on board led to the flight to change its course and fly due west. Investigations say the flight may have carried on for several hours. Transponders attached to the aircraft's engines were sending data. Analysis of data indicates the aircraft may have at some time been on the ground. Sunday it was revealed that prior to a final exchange of good night to Kuala Lumpur Air Traffic Control, the aircraft's Vital Communications Addressing and Reporting System, or ACARS, was shut down. This came as the plane's identification transponder had also been turned off deliberately. Analysts say only persons knowledgeable of aircraft would have taken such steps to shut down such communication and tracking systems. United States officials say the missing aircraft is likely to have been an act of piracy, as the search focuses on two corridors northwest from Thailand to the Kazakhstan-Turkmenistan border and another extending to the southern Indian Ocean. Defence analyst Carl Thayer with Australia's University of New South Wales says problems in the search point to the need for greater regional cooperation in air safety, especially between key powers such as the United States and China. Chinese authorities have also been critical of Malaysia's efforts to reveal information, as most passengers on board were Chinese nationals.
You know, lesson is that the major powers have got to learn how to cooperate, but the prime responsibility when the plane went down, or supposedly went down, South China Sea, Gulf of Thailand, is with Malaysia. from my reading, Malaysia at the beginning was very even-handed. But I think once you had the plane turning west, China was just left standing there, and then it moved into areas where India and the United States were better able to respond.
Thayer says regional bodies such as the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, and regional partners need to apply earlier agreements on security and safety reached after the September 11, 2001 attacks in the United States. He also pointed to operational complacency as a factor that can undermine air security and passenger safety. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
With no official information as to why Malaysia Airlines MH370 disappeared en route to Beijing, China, more than a week ago, and with many conflicting stories and ideas, it's still impossible to know what happened to the plane. Opinions on this mysterious event run the spectrum of possibilities. What do you think? You can join our poll found at voanews.com/daybreakasia. Now, normally, we unveil the final results just on our Monday morning program, and we are today, although we've been giving a running total over the past week to see how this is trending. With the plane's transponders apparently turned off deliberately, the number of those who chose terrorism has jumped now to 41%. 21% of our audience think mechanical failure is to blame, and almost 16% think human error is most likely. Weather playing a factor is now under 2%. Still a large number, but down a few points, 20%. Just don't know, based on the few facts that we do know so far. Again, our poll is at voanews.com/daybreakasia. It's unscientific, but an interesting reflection of what you and others in our audience are thinking. Now, for this week, our poll's going to shift a bit to possible locations of the plane. Data received from the engines indicate Malaysia Airlines MH370 could have flown for many hours after its last known position. Do you think it ended up in an ocean, on an island, inland Asia? It will never be found, or just not sure. You can cast your vote, voanews.com/daybreakasia. Still to come on Daybreak Asia, a new VOA investigative report shows a surprising surge in cell phone use inside North Korea. In southern Thailand, more than 200 suspected ethnic Uyghur Muslims are being held by Thai immigration authorities who say they will deport the men, women, and children to China. From Bangkok, we again hear from Ron Corbin, who reports for VOA that rights groups are calling for humanitarian protection for the group.
Thai immigration police said the 78 men, 60 women and 82 children are believed to be ethnic Uyghurs from China's western Xinjiang region. They were found hiding in a rubber plantation in Thailand's southern Songkhla province. The group has spoken with officials from the Turkish embassy, which along with the United Nations Refugee Agency has been providing assistance. They have refused to talk with Thai or Chinese embassy officials. Thai immigration officers say they will press charges against the group for illegal entry to Thailand and call for their deportation. But US-based Human Rights Watch is calling for the United Nations to assess the group's refugee status and ensure they are not forcibly returned to China. Sunay Pasuk, a senior researcher with the rights group, says Thailand has an international obligation to ensure the safety of the Uyghurs.
Thailand has an obligation under international customary law not to return people to a place where they would face danger. So that is a very core principle according to international law. So even though Thailand is not a party to the UN Refugee Convention, it is still has obligation under the law not to send people back to face dangers.
The US State Department also urged Thailand to provide protection to the group and ensure their humanitarian needs are met. Thai police reports say the Uyghurs left China's Xinjiang region by air to the southern Chinese city of Kunming, then went south through neighbouring countries Burma or Laos, or possibly Vietnam and Cambodia, before reaching Thailand. The next step was to Malaysia and a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Turkey. Trafficking gangs, said to be operating out of Malaysia, charge as much as $40,000 for each person. Rights groups warn of increasing numbers of ethnic Uyghurs fleeing China amid rising tensions in Xinjiang. Chinese authorities have tightened security there following attacks by suspected Uyghurs on Tiananmen Square in Beijing and more recently at Kunming Railway Station that left 29 people dead and 140 wounded. Human Rights Watch says Uyghurs face ethnic discrimination, religious repression and increasing cultural suppression by Chinese authorities who say they are fighting against separatism and terrorism. In recent years, despite efforts by the UN High Commission for Refugees to intervene, Cambodia forcibly returned 20 Uyghurs to China in 2009, while Malaysia deported 6 men in late 2012. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Two Tibetan monks set themselves on fire Sunday to protest Chinese rule. Sources tell VOA Tibetan journalists that a monk from Kirtit Monastery in China's Sichuan province set himself on fire near the monastery. Chinese security forces took him away, but it was not clear if he was alive or had died. A second monk set himself on fire in an ethnic Tibetan area of northwest China. The condition of that monk is also unknown. Since 2009, more than 120 Tibetans demanding the return of Tibetan leader the Dalai Lama and Tibetan freedom have self-immolated. The Tibetan administration in exile in Dharamsala, India, has urged Tibetans not to take such drastic action. And the U.S. government has called on China to resolve the Tibetan issue with a resumption of dialogue with representatives of the Dalai Lama. A Pakistani tribunal has taken 10 years off the 33-year sentence of a doctor who helped the U.S. spy agency find Osama bin Laden. Shaquille Afridi was convicted in May of 2012 of not working for the CIA, but on charges of giving money and providing medical treatment to Islamic militants. Afridi is believed to have been targeted by Pakistani authorities because of allegations that he ran a vaccination program to collect DNA and verify bin Laden's presence in the town of Abbottabad. The tribunal's ruling Saturday in the northwestern city of Peshawar came in response to an application by Afridi's lawyer for a new trial. The court rejected the request, and Afridi may still appeal further. Afghan authorities say necessary security measures are in place to guard the upcoming presidential polls, dismissing concerns Taliban threats and violence against election officials risk undermining the crucial vote. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad.
Afghanistan's elections for president and 458 provincial councillors are slated for April 5th. But deadly attacks on campaign workers and election officials have worried local as well as international observers. Since the start of the campaign period 6 weeks ago, independent monitors have reported at least 7 murders, 1 assassination attempt and several incidents of election-related violence and intimidation. The Taliban insurgency has vowed to use all force to disrupt the polls and has warned Afghans not to participate in it. Human Rights Watch has criticized as despicable and unlawful the Taliban's threat to use violence to prevent voters from choosing a new president. It has urged Afghan authorities to take all possible steps to protect campaign activities and voters. An Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman, Mohammad Najib Nekzad, says the government is fully prepared to organize free and transparent elections. He tells VOA about 400,000 Afghan soldiers and policemen are ready for deployment across the country to deter any threat to the democratic process. The spokesman dismissed the Taliban's threat of violence as propaganda, saying the Afghan government is not concerned and such moves will not prevent it from holding the elections. He added that only 4 districts across Afghanistan face serious security threats, but steps are being taken to deal with the challenge. While testifying before U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington last week, the top American commander in Afghanistan, General Joseph Dunford, also warned of an increase in the election-related violence, but said physical ability of the Afghan security forces is sufficient to deal with the security challenge.
There is no doubt in my mind, and we know this both from our intelligence and from open source, that the insurgency is focused on disrupting the elections in 2014 and focused on crushing the spirit and the will of the Afghan forces in 2014. Because they believe that we are leaving at the end of 2014, they look at this as a very critical year. And so what we expect to see are high-profile attacks to create the perception of insecurity.
The NATO-led international force will end its combat mission in December. The fate of a smaller American military presence in Afghanistan post-2014 remains uncertain because President Hamid Karzai has refused to sign a bilateral security agreement with Washington until certain conditions are met. On Sunday, former Afghan Defense Minister Rahim Vardak said he is withdrawing from the presidential race and will not endorse any other candidate. He did not give any reason for ending his campaign and was not considered a front-runner. Earlier this month, the current president's elder brother, Qayyum Karzai, announced he was ending his presidential campaign and supporting a former foreign minister, Zalmay Rasool, who is widely perceived as President Karzai's favored candidate. There are 10 male candidates in the race to replace President Karzai, who is unable to run in next month's vote due to constitutional term limits. In his last address to the joint session of parliament in Kabul Saturday, the Afghan leader reaffirmed his resolve to hold transparent and free elections. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
South Korean defense officials say the North has test-fired at least 18 short-range missiles into the sea, the latest in a series of launches that have provoked criticism from Seoul and Washington. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency quoted the officials as saying the missiles were fired late Sunday from the eastern coast of the Korean Peninsula and flew about 70 kilometers over the Sea of Japan. North Korea is not banned from short-range missile launches under UN sanctions. The aging parents of a Japanese woman kidnapped by North Korean agents in 1977 have met their Korean-born granddaughter for the first time. Japanese officials said Sunday Shigeru Yokota and his wife Sake spent several days with 26-year-old Kim Hoo-kyung in Mongolia last week. Kim's mother, Megumi Yokota, was kidnapped in Japan at the age of 13. She is believed to have married a South Korean man who had also been abducted to North Korea. North Korea says Kim's mother committed suicide in 1994, but Tokyo has rejected that claim, saying Pyongyang is lying about the status of Japanese abductees who are still missing. The kidnappings during the 1970s and 80s are a major issue standing in the way of relations between the two countries. A new report by the Voice of America and the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, or SAIS, shows that mobile phone use in North Korea has grown dramatically in recent years. The study provides some of the most detailed information to date about the mobile phone boom in the authoritarian and isolated nation, with many of its residents poor and hungry. The report found that the pace of subscriber growth has intensified since 2008, when North Korea's only official cell phone network, Korealink, launched a joint venture with Egyptian telecom firm Orascom, the majority stakeholder. In part one of a two-part interview, Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin speaks with the study's author, VOA Korean service reporter Yeonho Kim, to find out what inspired him to investigate the trend.
It has been a very interesting story to outside people, especially North Korea watchers, that they had a growing number of cell phone users in the country. As of May of last year, they reached 2 million subscribers, which is huge considering that this is a communist and very closed society. And the North Korean regime should and would know that cell phone played a very big role in the Arab Spring. So why in the world this regime would let people use cell phones? That was a big question among the North Korea watchers, but nobody had answers and clear idea of what exactly is going on there. And the U.S. Korea Institute at SAIS approached me and asked me if I could do a research project on this. And as a reporter, this is very interesting and very challenging, but I said this is worth trying. So that's how it started.
Well, given the challenges of doing that kind of research, finding that information, what techniques and methods did you use to try to get this information?
You know what? When I started this research project, I briefly regret that I decided to take this project because not many people did research on this. No relevant references that I could use. And even the South Korean experts who were supposed to know a lot about this, didn't have much idea about how to help me out. So the only way I can do research on this kind of subject is interviewing North Korean defectors who actually used cell phones back in North Korea. So I interviewed almost 20 defectors in Seoul, part of them while I traveled in Seoul. But most of them, after I came back to Washington and talked to them over the phone, and a lot of follow-up questions and even follow-up interviews I did.
How did you find those defectors, and how willing were they to share information with you? Did they express concern that what they tell you could put people in jeopardy or danger?
They didn't have that kind of concerns, but, you know, first of all, it is very hard to find those defectors who have their own stories about their cell phone usage in North Korea, because this is relatively very recent developments. So you need to find out somebody who defected like in 2011 or 2012. The service started late 2008, but at first it was only for the elite. So the normal people, they just started to use them around 2011 or 2012. So it is very hard to find them in Korea. And then among them, you need to find the people who actually use cell phones, which is more challenging. And the more recently you entered South Korea, the more they are suspicious of strangers. And if you say, I'm a reporter and can I interview? That's the last thing they want to hear from a stranger. So that was the biggest challenge to me. And I think that's why there are very few research on this. But fortunately enough, one of my friends in Seoul who used to work for Korean service at Voice of America introduced a very trustworthy and very smart North Korean defector in Korea, in Seoul. And thanks to these people, I was also introduced to some other North Korean defectors. And here I found trust building is the most important thing when you are doing interview with defectors. I didn't pay anything. If you pay for the interviews, there's more risk that they're going to say to you whatever you want to hear. But there was no reason for them to tell me a lie for nothing. They're just introduced by one of their best friends. And that really helped me out to get a real story and a very honest story from them.
Well, what were some of the most interesting things that you learned from the defectors about the usage of mobile phones in North Korea?
You know, at first you get the news that there are more than 2 million subscribers in North Korea. You might think, oh, then there should be some kind of telecommunication revolutions going on in North Korea. But based on the interview I did, what I learned was not really. That's not what's exactly going on there because of this expensive call rate, very high call rate. After using up just 200 free minutes per month, they need to pay like 10 to 20 times higher. And because of that, most of the people who use cell phone, they just limit their call to just important message or emergencies. And they try to make their calls as short as possible. And mostly they're using cell phones more as a personal entertainment device, listening to music, taking photos, rather than a communications device.
VOA Korean Service reporter Yeonho Kim speaking with Michael Lippin. On this week's Tuesday edition of Daybreak Asia, we'll bring you the second half of the interview in which Kim tells us why North Korea's totalitarian rulers are allowing more of their people to communicate by mobile phone despite the risks that entails for the phone users. Steve Norman's going to tell you all about the latest world news. He's next on International Edition. Please stay tuned. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese.